That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum on FUBAR Radio.
Hello and welcome to That Money Show. I am your host, Gabriel Nussbaum. And on today's show, we have a lot of exciting stuff. But first, let me give you some context. Let me give you some background to what we're trying to do here at That Money Show. Every week, we break down everything to do with personal finance. We take a little bit of a look at what's going on in the news and actually make it relevant to you listening at home so that you're not sitting there thinking to yourself, well, I just can't be bothered listening to anything about the economy. It's all boring. It's all negative. Let me actually bring the relevancy to you so you can adapt that into your own life. And then on top of that, every single week, we answer some money-related questions, you know, the ones that you're too embarrassed to ask or the things that you really never learned and you really thought that you should have learned, potentially even dating as far back as school. And lastly, we speak to a range of experts. And joining me this week, we have Emmy Dent, mortgage advisor, and Carrie Rattle, financial therapist and founder of Behavioral Sense. So that's who we are, and that is what we do. And let's dive straight into the economy. So this section, we like to call it the economy blitz. Why? Because I'm going to blitz through the top two or three stories that you really should know about every single week, because it affects the actual money in your pocket, rather than ignoring that subject altogether. So the first thing that I want to bring up today is what is going on with the households, in particular British households, who are enduring a second year in a row without improvement in their living standards. That being obviously in 2024 because of things such as high inflation, high interest rates. And this was a study done by the International Monetary Fund. So how bad is it looking? So apparently at the moment, the forecast is for this year that we're going to have a 0.5% growth. But because of rising population, that growth is going to be absolutely wiped out in terms of growth per head. So obviously, it's great if the economy is growing as a whole. That's good. But the population also increasing means that those people that are coming into the economy swallow up that growth. They kind of take it. And overall, what it said is we are expecting to remain completely flat. That is better than last year. So in 2023, we had a 0.3% drop in terms of growth per head. In other words, the living standards of the country as a whole was going down. We've kind of stabilized, and hopefully the outlook is going forward in the future, we can flip that around and start to become positive again. Now, the IMF have kind of backed that up. They said in the 2024, everything should start to pick back up. And they've actually said that it's going to be 2025 where this cost of living crisis, that is obviously the key word, the things that we're hearing all the time at the moment, should finally be over. Now, one thing that I was really interested in is what's going on across the world, because we know this cost of living crisis, we're not alone in this. It's happening all over Europe. It's happening in the US. I mean, quite often the UK gets kind of like told that we're kind of like, you know, following in second place behind the US. And what that means is when the US has a drop in inflation, we start to see drops in our inflation. When the US, you know, changes their interest rates, then our government starts to change their interest rates. So that's a really interesting one. What's the US kind of per capita, which means kind of per person growth, looking like for the year ahead? Well, they're looking at a 2.1% growth this year. And going around kind of other very developed countries, Germany's looking at 0.1% growth, France 0.5% growth, Italy 0.8% growth, Japan 1.3% growth, and Canada a minus 1.1% growth. So in other words, aside from Canada, the UK is actually in the second worst, well, the worst, like I said, aside from Canada, the worst position when it comes to this idea of increasing our living standards. And I feel like this isn't a surprise to anybody listening here today. I mean, we know that inflation is coming down, but inflation still exists. And what I mean by that is just because, you know, last year's inflation rate was 10% and this year's inflation rate is 3.2%, I believe, according to the latest figures, that's still inflation in terms of things are still going up in price. They're just not going up as quickly. And as long as, you know, the price of things go up, we stop producing as much and our incomes aren't keeping up with this kind of track with inflation, like we said, our living standards are going to go down. We're not going to be able to afford as much. Our physical salaries can't go as far anymore. I mean, I think I saw the one particular item at the moment was kind of from this year to last year, a the price of bread has gone from like £1.05 to £1.50. Now, obviously, that's a kind of really minute thing, and you're thinking, oh, it's an extra 40p, but that rolls into every single other aspect of kind of your shopping. And this isn't a great thing for the UK outlook. As an economy and as a whole, kind of the objective needs to be that the country gets richer as a whole. I mean, in the long term, that does happen. Think back to the richest person living, I don't know, 100 or 200 years ago, compared to people that are living, you know, in medium to low standards today. Theoretically, if you gave anyone the option as to who they would pick between, you know, high living standards in the late 1800s or low living standards in the early 2000s, you'd probably all take low living standards in the early 2000s. And why is that? That's because the economy as a whole, the nation as a whole, the world as a whole tends to get richer. And that richness stems from a few things. So, I mean, you can firstly think of technology. As technology advances, it kind of democratizes it to the all. And a great example of technology advancing is the idea of medicine. So medicines that allow us to now have average living ages till 80 only allow people in the 1800s to live till, I don't know what the exact numbers are, but 40 or 50 years old, let's say, was the standard. If I got that off, I may apologize, but I think I'm pretty confident in saying that in that entire period, the average age that people live to has gone up over the past 100 or 200 years ago. I'm fairly sure no statistic can prove that one wrong. So yes, we're kind of getting richer as a society over the long term. Another great thing that kind of improves and makes societies wealthier overall is, along with technology advancement, what that does is it makes the general cost of the things that we need every single day cheaper. So it's cheaper to ship things around the world. It's cheaper to produce food. The foods we're buying and making are cheaper as well. I know it doesn't feel like it because the price of living going up, but over the long term, that is kind of what it does. I mean, we're trying to, for example, as a society, bring water to the entire world for free. There are projects that are trying to do that. Clean drinking water. Now, go back, you know, even 20 years ago, that was probably a completely it was a mission. It was an objective. It was a dream. And nowadays, we're making that more and more reality. So all I'm trying to say is, in general, we do want living and that our kind of living standards to go up. And this kind of flat line and negative drop last year, whilst an anomaly, doesn't feel great in terms of, you know, who we are and the society we're living in, especially for young people, you know, people my age or just younger, leaving university for the first time, coming into the kind of economy. And all of a sudden, you know, from one year to the next, you know, from the age of 21 to 22, as you're meant to kind of get richer and richer, you're actually getting poorer. Practically, according to this study. So that's just something to be aware of. We want this to go up. Hopefully the cost of living crisis does get declared, you know, over as soon as possible. If 2025 is that year, obviously not ideal. We'd rather it was this year, but at least there's kind of that end in sight. And we really kind of want to push the UK as an economy to not just, you know, be flatline and be better than last year, but to compete against the other big economies. Like I said before, the US is at 2.1% compared to our flatlining. Not great. A second story that I want to share, because again, it's so relevant to so many of our listeners, and also selfishly, it's so relevant to me, myself, and I, is the idea of first-time buyers facing their toughest conditions in 70 years to buy a home. This kind of seems like the news every single week at this point. I mean, let me share with you my own personal story. I mean, I'm hopefully going to be trying to get onto the property market for the first time at the age of 26, 27 years old, but that is a complete anomaly. For the average person now, I believe their first time property will come within their 30s. If you go back to the generation beforehand, it was never that. It was, you know, mid 20s, something like that. And there's this whole argument as to the old people think the older generation are arguing that, you know, they had it harder, they had higher interest rates versus we have it harder. But let me kind of break down that argument with some statistics that I was looking into when I saw this story of us having it the hardest that we've had it in 70 years. Well, I think the first thing that makes it so hard for this young generation coming through is the way that rents are going up so quickly. So again, if you don't follow the economy, you might just feel that year on year, like your landlord has done something absolute crazy. Maybe you're paying, I don't know, £1,000 a month, and all of a sudden he's asking for 1,200, 1,300, you know, 20, 30% rises. And these aren't things that are coming out of nowhere. You're not alone. It says here that the latest figures are saying that private rental costs have gone up by 9.2% in the last year. So let's kind of round that to 10% increase. That's crazy, right? 10% year on year on year will basically make living unaffordable for young people. Well, for most people, full stop. And everyone, if you have the option to move home, I mean, I always remember when I moved out of home, my parents were like, oh, you're crazy. Like, save as much as you can. But now looking at the statistics, like, they were probably right. I was crazy moving out for home, and I should have probably saved as much as I could and stayed at home. And it's becoming kind of less of a thing to, or a taboo, or something that you like don't want to do, and more of something that's more common and more accepted amongst people. They just understand that young people don't have the feasibilities. One really interesting thing that popped out to me when I was looking into this story was the idea that half of first-time buyers in their 20s were getting help of an average of £25,000 from their parents. Why did that kind of pop out to me? I mean, it's obvious. That's a huge amount of money to be gifted or given by your parents. But it's another idea that it seems that unless you have, for example, a partner and you're going to buy a property together, and you're both high-earning individuals coming together to get a mortgage and a deposit, etc., the only other route you have to getting on the property ladder is with generational wealth and having that passed down from a previous, you know, from a parent or a grandparent. Which is absolutely crazy, the idea that the average person nowadays on their own earning an average salary can't even, you know, do the basic, afford to put a roof over their head and buy that. They'd have to just continue renting because the affordability is going out the window. And it gets obviously worse with different areas of the country. On average, apparently at the moment, it's 7 times an average salary is the cost of the average cost of a house. Now, obviously, with mortgage brokers only lending 4 to 5 times your average salary and the average house costing 7 times, you can see the misalignment there. You're never going to be able to get that mortgage to afford even the average price of a house. But move down to London and that price becomes 12.66 times the average salary. So the average house price in London is 12.66 times. That's like 3 times higher than what they'll even ever lend you in terms of mortgage. So now you can see, even with two average salaries, that's maybe 8 times. So you get 8 or 9 or 10 times the multiple in terms of when you borrow for a mortgage. But things are just crazy right now. I mean, I don't want to say like there's no hope, but it's clearly just that this is a huge issue that needs to be tackled by the government. And I think that the key to kind of start getting the government to even look into this is just making sure that the nation as a whole have awareness. And that's what I'm trying to do through sharing you these stories. You've got awareness of the issue. You now know it's an issue. And hopefully through combined voices, through petitions, and, you know, through speaking to the people that can actually make a change, now you're aware that this isn't just you facing this. This is a statistical problem that is facing not just the average person, but every person. Things can start to change. Because if house prices keep going up at the rate they're going out, even though they dropped last month, but when looking at kind of big picture and salaries don't keep going up at that same rate, this kind of divide between ever buying a first time property and, you know, just, you know, renting forever or requiring to move into your parents for longer and longer, or, you know, renting and, you know, never moving out, in other words, throughout your entire lifetime, this problem is going to get worse, not better. You might start to see first-time properties, you know, for 40-year-olds rather than being in your 30s. I don't know. Kind of ranting now again. A lot of the show seems to be ranting, but I think it's just awareness that's really necessary here for the younger generation. And as long as you can be aware that this is what's going on, then hopefully change can start to happen. Anyway, that brings me to the end of the news blitz. I promise I will try to bring in more positive news going forward in the future, but we are in a cost of living crisis. And the key, like I said, is just awareness at this point. But hopefully through the next kind of segments of the show, we can make things more positive and answer some more questions and really kind of level up your personal finances. So straight after this, I will be speaking to Emmy Dent. She is a mortgage advisor. And yeah, it will be an absolutely brilliant conversation.
FUBAR Radio presents
What the Health with Gabby Allen.
Joining me now is Millie Gooch, author and founder of Sober Girl Sobriety Society. I need to know what is so bad about dating sober. I think it's just terrifying when it's something that you're not used to, because when I was drinking and dating, you know, like, you use it to calm your nerves, you use it for confidence, you rely on it. And I think that's the one thing I realised when I stopped drinking is how much I really relied on alcohol. I was always kind of saying, you know, like, oh, I'm not dependent on it, but for my confidence I was really. But I also think there's so many benefits to it. Like, I used to go on so many dates when I was drinking, I'd be like, they are the one, and then I'd meet them a few weeks later sober and I'd be like, we've got nothing in common, what was going through my mind? I'd be like, oh, it was because I was drunk.
Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
Harpreet, how are you, my love?
I'm great, thank you. How are you? It looks fun in there.
I want to talk about this because obviously you met your partner on The Apprentice. When did you start to get that feeling, I'm into him and this is more than just a banter or a friendship? Because it's a close environment being on a show like that, isn't it?
I really wish I could sit here and give loads of juicy gossip that actually we used to secretly meet in the laundry room on the show, but we didn't. And when I actually last spoke with yourselves, I think it was right after I'd won, we weren't even flirting, never mind dating. First time that I thought I actually fancied him was when I watched him on TV and I watched episode one. Hang on. You know, he's actually really good looking.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani.
And joining me in the studio, we have Deputy Leader of the Green Party, Zach Polanski. Zach, thank you so much for joining us. How are you keeping, Zach?
I'm great. Thanks for having me. How are you?
So you're hoping for four MPs in the general. You think that's going to happen?
Yeah, that's absolutely the minimum at what we're
I don't want to be Piers Morgan here, but will you take a... I don't have £1,000, will you take a £100 bet with me that you'll get four MPs?
Well, I do everything in politics to talk about the harms of gambling. So for me to very place good. A bet on there would be pretty, you know, pretty horrendous.
Before we had you on, we discussed with the producers as to whether I should do the bet joke, and I said I would because I had every faith that you would answer it in the way I expect a politician of any moral
standing. We should also talk about cryptocurrency, which also is very problematic.
Rishi, if you're listening, mate, that's how you answer a betting question.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
Hello and welcome back. As I was just telling you earlier, first-time buyers, according to this recent report, are facing the toughest conditions in 70 years to buy a home, with many relying on either dual high incomes, that means two people having to buy a property together, or parental support. And that means that we've brought on the absolute perfect guest who will be able to explain the questions that you probably have off the back of that story. So joining me now, Emmy Dent, mortgage advisor. Emmy, lovely to have you on the show and welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having us.
It's so great to have you here. Like I said, we were just talking about this issue of, you know, young people and their inability to afford and that being backed up by the statistics, and having a mortgage advisor is a great person to have to kind of start easing, let's hope, the stress of young people at home. But I want to know what your initial reaction is to that study that says it's the toughest conditions in 70 years.
So I've just had a brief look and I couldn't agree more, if I'm being honest, like just dealing with it day in, day out. I think the biggest problem is it's not a level playing field. So everyone's sitting and looking at social media and they're like, oh, they've bought a house and they've bought a house. And everyone around them feels like they're moving and buying houses. But no one knows how many people's income's on there. They don't know how much help they've had from the parents. So they don't know what area they're buying in. It's such an unlevel playing field. So people can feel like, oh, I'm not doing enough. But it's like I'm from the Northeast. I was not very young, but I was quite young when I bought my first home. And that was just pure luck because I lived in the Northeast. Otherwise, I'd have been absolutely knackered, to put it politely, because it can be impossible. And like, when we've got single people buying properties, I want to be like, I just want to let you know how proud I am of you, because it's so bloody hard.
I can't even imagine. I mean, I'm lucky to be in a dual income household, and we're able to kind of start now looking at the process. But it's kind of like a tax on the single income earner, right? It's a punishment for being single these days. If you don't have someone to buy a property with, the odds of you ever getting onto that property market just go down and down. It's just going to be a later and later age. I mean, are homes becoming inaccessible to first-time buyers? I mean, I think we know now the average age is now within the 30s. It's not in the 20s anymore that people are doing it. And like I said before, you need that second income or you need help from parents. So let's say you are just that person that's on an average salary, doesn't have parents that can support them. What position are they left in at this point?
I know. So it really truly does depend on where you live in the UK as well, because what can be seen is, oh, it's not ideal, but it's not too bad further north. In London, it's like, no, I could literally save for my entire life and I still wouldn't have the deposit that I need to buy a one bedroom flat in London by myself. So it is so hard. What I would say is my best advice is to speak to someone early, speak to an advisor, speak to a broker, because what I'm finding is people are coming to me and saying, look, I'm saving. I don't really know what I'm saving to, like what the aim is, because I don't know what the hell I'm doing. And we say, right, you've got options when you hit this amount or this amount or this amount of deposit, or with your income, the only way to get what you need is you need a higher income. And don't get us wrong, they're not nice conversations to have, but people are going away going, right, well, if I stay where I am in this job without being able to increase my wage, I'm not going to be able to buy in this area. So it's more just doing the research early, but it's a hard market at the minute.
I love that, because I think something that you just played onto there is that it's not a black hole. It's never a never-ending thing. By speaking to someone, you can actually start to build the plan to understand what your options are, right? So rather than, you said, just putting away savings, not knowing how much, not knowing where it's going, not knowing what salary you'll ever be able to need to do what you want to do, the idea is hopefully by speaking to the professionals, you can start to pick your options, know your time scales. And I think that's so important. Whenever I speak to anyone about short-term savings, because it's not just a house deposit, there are so many things that people want to have short-term savings for, weddings, cars, you know, the lot. You can't just have this black hole where you're not quite sure what the money you're putting away is. You need to know, this is how much, and if I save up X amount every single month, I will hit that goal. So we've kind of switched the narrative. Things are possible. Like you said, it's just looking at all of your options. As a mortgage advisor, can you help people understand what the process is from even how to find a mortgage advisor and then how that will get them from point A of wanting to buy a property to point B of buying a property?
Yeah, totally fine. So, because even finding a mortgage advisor, you're like, am I ready for that yet? Is that the right? Am I doing this right? And then like, what do you write in an email? Hi, I think I may possibly at some point, but I'm not sure where, want to buy a house. Can you help us? So it's more, firstly, you don't need a mortgage broker. I am a mortgage broker and I love being a mortgage broker, but you don't need one of us. It's just a bit easier. And we can be quite helpful sometimes. You could walk in to a bank and say, hiya, I'm trying to buy a house. I don't know how much I need to save. Can we see what I can borrow, right? And they'll do what's called a decision in principle or an agreement in principle. They're all the same. They're just called different things. And they'll literally go, right, so you can have a mortgage of X amount based on your income and your outgoings. Or they'll say, we can't offer you a mortgage. Only issue with doing it direct with the bank is every bank gives you a different amount. So you could walk into your high street bank and come out feeling horrific because they've said, nah, you can't have that. But you could walk over the road to a different bank and get 50 grand more. So that's the benefit of a broker, I suppose. But honestly, quick Google searches. A lot of people find me on TikTok, which is a bit mental, but it's 2024, so yeah. and just, I like, and to be honest, when you work with me, you've got to send us a dog picture. I know that sounds a bit insane, but I really like dogs. So you say, hiya, I live in a flat and I want to buy a house. This is the dog that will be running around the garden. And I'm like, brilliant, let me help.
I'm ready. I want to work hard for you now that I know there's a dog on the line.
Yeah, but literally just doing a quick Google search and just getting a rough idea. If you're like, I think I've got my deposit saved, then speak to a few brokers and see who you like the best, because you are tied with them for 6 months. So if you think, oh, they're not very nice, don't pick them. And then all they'll do is they'll go through your income and outgoings. They'll ask for your documents, like pay slips, bank statements, all of that jazz. They usually ask for the credit file as well, which I do, just to see if there's anything on there. At this initial stage, you'll see if you're going to run into any red flags. Credit files, there'll be so many things that people are like, whoa, hold on, I've paid that bill, but it's not right on your credit file. So then you've got to spend 2 months updating that before you can apply for a mortgage. So it's worth starting early. There's no harm in starting early is what I'm saying, really.
That's brilliant. So it's just, you can find any advisor, ping them a line, send them a picture of your pet. And 9 times out of 10, they won't think that you're completely crazy if you send them a picture of your pet. And the whole idea is they can give you this step-by-step process of how to hopefully get yourself into the property market. And like you said, you can go into banks, but hopefully using a mortgage advisor, they kind of speed that process up for you, so you don't have to do all of the hunting and the searching yourself. That's their job, right? Is to do all of that research for you and tell you, well, this is the bank account that's right for you, best rate, best borrowing levels, et cetera, et cetera. If I'm someone that thinks to myself, they hear the word advisor or mortgage broker and they think that's really expensive, you know, I can't afford, or can I even afford to go to someone for advice? I need to do all the groundwork myself because I barely have the money for a deposit, let alone to find someone to do it for me. What's the answer to that?
So your banks won't charge you. If you go direct to a bank, they won't charge you, but then you've got to do the legwork yourself to work out which bank's going to be the cheapest. Some big firms don't charge fees that are big. If you Google fee-free mortgage advisors, there are plenty of them, to be honest. I came from one of them, like I started there, and I'm not going to lie, it was great learning, but I was dealing with that many clients. If someone rang me in a panic, I didn't have time to say, hiya, tell us what's going on. So we do charge. We don't charge until we're submitting an application. So all of your decision in principle, all of the how much you can borrow, talking through your process, you're not going to get charged then. It's only when you've found a house, had an offer accepted, and you're physically, like we're physically submitting the application, that we charge. You also get free remortgages for the lifetime of the property, but
That's really important to hear. So the whole idea is you're not going to get charged until, like you said, that actual point at the end of the process. You'll know how much you can afford by that point. Then I've done kind of the groundwork for you. You pay the fee after that. And like I said, there are options to look for fee-free mortgage advisors, and there are options to go to the bank direct who also can't charge you. And I think what is really important to tell people listening is that this arguably will be the biggest purchase of your entire life. So really take your time with it. And just because, you know, like a mate has done it one way and they've told you that's the way they did it, you need to make sure that you've kind of, you know, checked everything off. So maybe do try all of those options. Like you said, speak to a small mortgage broker, speak to a large firm that doesn't charge a fee, and then also walk into a bank and have a conversation with them and see kind of who you feel the most comfortable with to take you forward on that path. I mean, have you ever had someone approach you and you said, like, listen, we're great, but I think you could go and speak to a bank and just get this done yourself? I mean, are there routes that ever come to you that way? Or is it just literally just, do you open up and tell people this is the biggest purchase of your life? Please take your time and make sure that we're the right partners for you on this journey.
Yeah, it's more, honestly, it is more about like liking the person personally. So like if you put me and another mortgage broker together, 9 times out of 10, we're going to get similar interest rates. But if you think, I get quite a lot of emails saying, hiya, my broker's told us this, is that right? And I'm like, if you're asking that question, that's not your right broker, because you need, it's a big deal. We get quite a lot where they've been to the banks and the banks have said no, and they're like, ah, yeah, I know this, they've said no and I feel really bad, and like I just want to double check. And then we check someone at other lenders and they fly through and they're like, oh. And that's when they kind of see the value of having a broker. But it is one of them where you just got to go who you're comfortable with.
Yeah, I think that's completely right. Like I said, I'm going through this journey myself right now, and I remember, like, you get referred one mortgage broker, but the truth is just speak to a couple. And like you said, it's about the one that you like, the one that you trust as well, and the one that is getting the right answers for you ultimately, because you might like them, but if they're not doing a good job, they're also not the right option for you. I want to ask you a slightly different question. I think that we've got lots of different products coming out that are trying to help, I suppose, first-time buyers. You're seeing 99% mortgages coming out. We've got lifetime ISAs and products like that. But specifically with the 99% mortgage, this idea that you only need 1% of the property's price as a deposit. What are your opinions on this, and what's the kind of person this might be suited towards?
So anything that is a scheme, right, I take with a pinch of salt, because it's normally just to get publicity. And if it's a government scheme, then it's usually even worse. I actually like the bank schemes better than the government schemes most of the time, but it is usually for a very, very small amount of people. With these new, it's a £5,000 deposit scheme, so it's up to 99% loan of value, meaning you don't need a full 5% deposit, you just need £5,000 up to a house price of £500,000. So for some people it's perfect. The people who've got the high incomes but they're paying a bloody fortune out in rent and they can't save these massive deposits, but they live in an area where they can't even start looking until they've got £20,000 in the bank, then it can be really helpful for them. Mm-hmm. If it's people who are on your low, because your affordability checks are the same, you've still got to pass the affordability checks, which can be an issue in themselves. So it's more people who are paying so much out in rent that they physically cannot save another penny, that it can work, because they're like, hold on, my payments are going to be the same or less than what I'm paying in rent. So it can really work. Other people, they're like, the interest rate's too high, it's cheaper in renting, and it can be. So it's, and your credit, not to add another thing to the list of things you need, you need to have good credit, right? Because from the bank's point of view, they're kind of just giving you this mortgage with not very much of your money in the house and going, I bloody hope they'll pay this mortgage back. So interest rates are higher and your credit rating's got to be like good. What I mean by that is no mispayments, no defaults, and no CCJs in 6 years. I've run quite a few of these in the last few weeks, and basically any blips in the last 6 years is going to mean you're not eligible.
You need to be perfect, more or less. No, I think that you've said that really nicely. It's this idea that there are going to be flashy things that are thrown out to people, but you really need to make sure that they are suited for you. Don't just go for them because of a cool title or little amounts of money put down. And I think that you stressed that really nicely. Could I just ask you in one sentence, as a final question, what is one of the most important things you wished young people knew when it came to mortgages?
I wish everyone understood how important it is to not miss any payments on little daft things when you're young. And I'm talking phones, like current accounts, just insurance. Make sure you're making them minimum payments. You might not think it's a big deal, but it can be coming down the line when you need to get a mortgage.
Absolutely perfect. Well, thank you so much for joining today. I hope that everyone listening feels a little bit more positive when it comes to houses and buying their first property. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. Well, that was absolutely world class. I mean, we've gone from, you know, that kind of doom and gloom of, you know, worst time in 70 years to buy a first time property to actually having a bit of a plan and a bit of, you know, a step by step process thanks to Emmy. So hopefully you can see the value we get from bringing in those experts. And now quickly, I do want to share with you what I like to call my money tip of the week. And I'm going to actually keep it on theme about properties. This one's to do with lifetime ISAs. Whether you've heard of them or whether you haven't heard of them, if you are saving for a first time property, Google a lifetime ISA, find a good provider and put £1 in. All that does is it means that you can use this lifetime ISA product to purchase a property within 1 year from now. It sets the clock going, in other words. A lifetime ISA is just a product that allows you to save towards a first-time property and then adds a 25% bonus on anything that you save. So there's lots of different perks. And I do want you to go and do your own research, because that's not what the tip of the week is. The tip is just, if you are between the age of 18 and 39, thinking about buying a first-time property, put £1 in to set the clock going, because you need to wait at least a year before you can use that kind of product. And then you can do the research, look into it, and understand whether or not it's worth something to you. But £1 seems worth the risk to me. Anyway, that brings us to the end of this short section. And straight after the break, I'm going to be joined by Carrie Rattle. She is a financial therapist and a founder of Behavioral Sense. We'll see you then.
Hey!
FUBAR Radio presents.
Access all areas.
Mark from Married at First Sight UK.
See, at the wedding, you told Sean you were 26, but you're actually 36.
Oh, yeah.
So drop in that decade. We ain't gone 1 or 2 years either side. What was going through your head when you thought, I'm going to shave off 10 years.
A 26. Third of your life.
Yeah.
It was instant reaction. As soon as anyone says to me, how old are you? I'm like 26. I just stopped counting after 26. Would I have told him? Probably not.
No. Yeah. Ever?
Well, maybe when we're 80 years old and we've got the grandkids running round.
Except like, you wouldn't be 80 years old. You'd be 90.
I'd be 26 still. I'd be going around the corner for some more injections.
Politics Uncensored.
Joining me now, the former leader of the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, MP. And there you are stood with hundreds of thousands of people at Glastonbury singing "Oh Jeremy Corbyn." What is that like?
It was quite extraordinary. It was an amazing experience, and I was very pleased we did it. We wrote, the office got very excited about Glastonbury. Every single person in the office thought it was necessary for them to be at Glastonbury.
Yeah, I'm sure they did. Yeah.
Every single one said it's really necessary for them to come.
The Dating Show.
I'm friends with a fair few exes, and I think you can be friends with an ex, but I genuinely do. But I do think that it's timing is everything with that.
Well, I think it depends what you cast as a friend.
Yeah,
are you talking about, you know, someone you're going to hang out with on your sofa? Like, if you've already shagged, you know, isn't that a bit weird? Or is
no,
it
I
weird?
Think that's a different level of friend. I think that's a different level of... You can be friends with someone. You can't be, like, best fucking friends with someone. I mean, I've got exes that I talk to about their current partners and whatever else, and they'll tell me about that sort of stuff. But I wouldn't say, oh, do you want to come over for fucking Chinese and chill on the sofa?
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
Hello and welcome back to That Money Show with That Money Guy. I'm Gabriel and we are bringing yet another brilliant guest on to today's show. The reason I'm so excited about this one in particular is because of one of my favorite ever books within the personal finance world. It's titled The Psychology of Money. I think psychology is as important as maths when it comes to understanding personal finances. And that's why joining me now, we have Carrie Rattle, a financial therapist and founder of Behavioral Sense, who is the perfect person to bring that kind of entire sentence to life. Carrie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Gabriel, thank you for having me. This is good fun. I look forward to it.
Yeah, we're going to have some fun on the show talking about this idea of psychology and how it impacts money. But can we start with a very simple question? Who can benefit from financial therapy?
If you aren't managing your money according to your needs, your values, or your goals, you can benefit from financial therapy. It's all about uncovering deep-seated money beliefs that you have developed since childhood and helping you become aware of those, how they're self-sabotaging, as well as all of your subconscious money behaviors that get in the way.
That is an excellent and very to the point answer. I really appreciate that. And I couldn't agree more. I mean, one statistic that I often bring up with the UK is that one in every three adults in this country have less than £1,000 in their savings account. And I think what that shows is that these kind of financial struggles that people are having isn't just for the minority anymore. It's becoming a mass problem. And like you said, these are probably related more and more to your psychology, your upbringing, than you know. And I'd love to know, with your experience and I suppose the sessions and everything you've done with your line of work, what are the main barriers that people face trying to overcome this idea of managing their money in an efficient way versus this idea that it just disappears and they have no control over their finances?
So the first one I'm going to share, and I've got four different barriers, but the first one is most important. Saving is unnatural for our brain. How's really? That?
Yeah, that's
so. Here's what
me.
I mean. We have an old brain and a new brain. Your old brain is sort of, you know, back lower side of your skull. Your new brain is your prefrontal cortex, closer to your forehead. Well, your old brain kind of runs the show as soon as you get emotional. Your old brain is still walking around with fur and a club. So it's living back in Neanderthal days when your old brain would say, eat everything you can because you may not have food tomorrow. Gather everything you can because you may run out. So for our brain to think, oh, I should think ahead, tuck money aside. I don't have to consume it all because it's not a big risk like it used to be in Neanderthal days. So our old brain, when it's running the show, makes saving incredibly unnatural. So that's number one. So if you think you're terrible and a bad person because you can't save, no, you just have your old brain running the show. Second of all, you need a compass, something that gives you joy, that improves your life, so that you want to save for it. Everybody talks about saving for retirement. Start with something simpler and shorter term. Because if you don't have a compass, then you never have to make a choice. You just spend on whatever you want to today instead of having to make a choice between today or tomorrow. The third one, of course, is we tend to put saving last on our list. And we should put it almost first on our list. Have it taken out of your checking account, right? Because as soon as you leave it last, you've got all these emotions that have led you to spending all month, there's not going to be anything left. And fourth, we are also not wired to pre-plan. So pre-planning to save for something is a new behavior. And if we don't learn it, then we don't do it.
I think that all of those, anyone listening to those four barriers is probably sitting there nodding along going, wow, all four of those affect me. And the truth is, you could be the best saver in the world, but at some point, those four barriers have impacted your life at some point. And I particularly like the first one, which I think I would translate as you're just bad at saving because you're a human being. It's kind of built into us as these creatures that we grow. Like you said, our evolution has come from people that said, we are living in the here and now, spend for the here and now, because you don't know what tomorrow might bring. And these are kind of things that, of course, we need to get over. We can't just eat everything in sight anymore, because otherwise we would, you know, like be in a completely obese society. And there's that kind of finds itself into other areas. And I think the answer to this question is going to be really obvious, but I'd love you to dive into more detail. It's kind of, is there a link between human emotions and money, and how does that affect people and their relationship with money?
So there is emotion in every money decision we make, and logic in few. How do you like that?
That's
right. So we may think we are making the most logical decision in the world, and logic tends to kick in when we're doing something bigger, like buying a car or looking at a house or something like that. But when you think about it, even when you're buying a car, you may look at mileage, you may look at how many passengers are you going to have. Do you want it to be a really good, reputable brand? But at the end of the day, you're also going to decide, oh, but I really like the color on this one, or I really like these leather seats in this one. You know, so the emotion kicks in. And, you know, here are a couple of examples, because it happens all the time. Let's say you get a raise. So that's an event. Then you get excited about getting that raise. You may feel rich. You may want to celebrate. So you go out and spend. So all of this happens naturally, quickly, without even thinking about it. And it can also happen when you're having frustrating days, like you work for a living, you're having a lousy day, nothing is getting done. So people will go out and spend because searching, hunting down, capturing something they buy makes them feel successful. So it helps balance out the frustrating day. So everything we do has an emotional component.
That's a really interesting thing you just mentioned. I've never thought of shopping as capturing something to make yourself feel like you're a success. Is that the root? Is that the way that you analyze spending? Because I know that you're also a compulsive shopping coach. And I've never associated buying something with feeling successful.
That is one feeling. So, you know, I work with compulsive shoppers, yes, a lot every day. I work with general overspenders as well. It's a continuum, right? Sometimes spending is a form of escape. A lot of people sought out spending in COVID. First of all, they needed to adapt their lives, but then it allowed them to take control. They could control by getting something, receiving a package that made them happy. So sometimes it's control, sometimes it's self-soothing, sometimes it's success, sometimes it's all about status. You know, you're triggered because your friend just got something that you need to have as well. There are so many different reasons that drive you to overspending, and some of it has to do with your money beliefs. So if you believe money is status, you will spend regularly to keep up with the group you want to be associated with, and you won't even realize you're doing it.
Keeping up with the Joneses, am I right? That's the saying. You look right, you look left. If your neighbor has it, if your friend has it, you all of a sudden have this urge to have it as well. I feel like there are so many studies about, you know, the satisfaction you'll feel, let's say if you're earning one salary but your peers earn a higher salary, versus the exact same feeling of earning the exact same mathematical number if your peers were earning a lower salary, and the satisfaction you would feel, which I think does logically make sense, right? It's this idea of kind of pursuit of what you don't have and how to take control of that. And one difficulty or reason that I know people find or have difficulty taking control of their money was a study that I read that said our financial attitude is set at just 7 years old. Now, I don't know the number that is kind of widely discussed across society, but this was saying that a large part of who we are when it comes to money is set as young as just 7 years old. Have you seen that in actual reality? And is there kind of case studies you'd be happy to share with us and to understand like what's happening at seven that affects you at 27, 37, 47?
So I've not read that study, so that's very cool. I'm going to look it up. I know financial behaviors are absolutely created and are pretty well cemented by definitely an early age. At seven, you hit a point where you can understand and learn to start making choices. You have some context. So you might hear dad say, oh, Harry next door just bought a new car. Maybe I should get a new car. So there's a small context. You don't know the world yet, but you know your family world. And you are also able to, you know, count to a certain degree, right? So you can count money. You can learn how to shop, buy small treats at a store, count out the change. Saving is a concept that you can understand at that point. And also, you know, giving to charity, which some people believe is also a money behavior they want to have with all their other behaviors, you know, saving, spending, and that kind of thing. So I do believe it still develops, but some of your core starts at a very basic level, yes, around seven.
Yeah, I can completely resonate. I feel like you've brought that study to life for me without even having read it yourself, and I'll definitely share it with you after the show. So let's take a look at the flip side. We understand these difficulties that people face and some of the reasons intrinsically that people face them from a psychological perspective. What's the flip side? What are some things that we can do? Again, removing mathematics from the equation and re-bringing back in emotions and understanding ourselves as human beings that can help us start to level up and improve our ability and relationship with money.
Absolutely. So if you really have a terrible relationship with money, I do encourage you to just talk with a financial therapist a bit. They will help. Let's go back to the old brain for a second. So now you know you have this old brain that doesn't believe in saving. It's all about managing your emotions, because your old brain, when emotional, overrides your new brain, right? Your new brain loses out. So it's managing the old brain. It's calming your emotions. So first of all, if you think you are emotional, and it takes a while to understand this because we go out and behave with money without thinking about it. Money is in our lives every single day. Breathing really helps. If you think you're really angry or frustrated or really excited, breathe. Take deep breaths because it calms down the emotions. It helps you regulate and let your prefrontal cortex at least have a say in the matter. Second of all, find a compass. Everybody has a compass. You love your kids. Maybe it's saving for college. And every time you put a little bit of money in an account for them, you feel joy. You're taking care of them. It could be an awesome trip, right? You really want to see part of the world. Every time you pull out your credit card or your phone to pay for something, think, do I really want this? Or am I just going to have a blast in Southeast Asia when I get there? Whatever it may be, so having a compass. And third, you really want to take the emotion out of saving by having it occur automatically, not last in the month, but first, right out of your paycheck. Because the more decisions you have to make, the more you get caught up in making decisions, it takes too much energy, it's tiring, so you don't bother. If you just take a little bit of money out of your paycheck, after a while, you don't miss it, you don't think about it, there's no decision to be made. It's like super, super easy.
I think those are excellent. And I love to hear them from kind of your perspective, because these are, again, similar concepts to what a lot of personal finance experts bring up. This idea that you need to pay yourself first with your money, right? Because if why are you paying everyone else in your life first? Why does, you know, shop over here get some of your money and restaurant over here get some of your money, but you pay yourself last? Like, conceptually, you can start to hear how crazy that sounds. And also, like you said, having an actual target. If I don't know what my money's going towards, I've got no incentive to put it away. I don't. And like you said, a pension is obviously a really tangible one and an important one, retirement. But it's hard to relate to. How can 21-year-old Jack, who's just got his first ever job out of university or college, going to be excited about putting away money for a 70-year-old version of himself? No. What's happening in the next 3 years of your life? Is there a project? Maybe it's a deposit for a house. Like you said, maybe a trip. Calculate how much that's going to cost you, and every month, break it down month by month and put that amount away. I love all of that. I'd love to kind of hear one last piece of advice from yourself, particularly speaking to the younger generations. We've obviously grown up in a world now that is full of social media, comparison culture, you know, this idea that all of a sudden you're showing off your best version of yourself and no one shows off the worst version of themselves. I'd love to hear, A, how people can start to, you know, still use social media, but use it in a safe way for their own money. And B, I suppose one great tip you would have to allow people to understand that that isn't reality and how to emotionally keep themselves on check and stay safe.
So social media can be great, right? You and I like to educate people on social media.
Absolutely.
But if you want to be manipulated and controlled all day, every day, stay on social media. So here's what I mean by this. Number one, everything out there is now entertainment. So there are ads out there entertaining you, sneaking up on you, persuading you to buy things, and you don't even know it. Number two, there is a new profession called neuromarketing. These people test how your brain works and create ads accordingly. What colors you like, what packaging you respond to, what songs you respond to. And then they create advertising accordingly. So you are being manipulated and sucked in on a regular basis. Third, there's the ad tracking, which I refer to as ad stalking. So you may be able to tell by my words, Gabrielle, that I'm trying to get people to feel outraged. I don't want you to sit there and say, yeah, I want to be manipulated and controlled. I want to be stalked. So when I look at something and don't buy it, advertising keeps stalking you because it won't let you give in. It will not honor you or respect you because you chose not to buy it. It keeps running after you. So is that what you want to put up with? So here's what I would do. First of all, I turn off the sound a lot because we are trained, just like good old Pavlov's dog, right? When the bell rings, we are trained to do something. We are trained to pick up our phone and respond. Instant is not urgent. Take time out with your phone. You will find you'll be in the middle of a day and you're actually doing something on your phone and you didn't even realize you picked it up and started looking at it. So if you turn off the sound and you put it away for periods of time, you are actually going to find your anxiety decreases, spending decreases, and you are less concerned with comparing yourself to not only the Joneses next door, but the Joneses around the world, who are all using, you know, fake environments, photoshopping, pretend lives that we all think we need to keep up with when it's not even true.
Amazing. Well, Carrie, I want to say thank you so much. I love that last practical step of just turn off the sound, start there, and hopefully we can start to build a society that isn't so easily manipulated. But yeah, thank you again for your time. Some really interesting insights that I know that our viewers and listeners will really appreciate. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Gabriel.
Cheers. Brilliant. So two incredible guests, one psychologist, one mortgage advisor. I mean, we are really trying to bring you every perspective under the sun. And now to shift gears a little bit, we like to have a section here called Scam of the Week, where I bring up something that just doesn't feel right when it comes to our own personal finances and help you understand what's going on. And this is a really interesting one because I read it earlier this week that apparently gift cards in shops, you know, you go into a shop and you see that little piece of plastic and you want to buy it for a friend or you buy it for yourself. There's a big scam going on where they're basically being taken off the shelf by criminals. They're having their, you know, foil ripped off or whatever it is on the back, scratched off. The code is being stolen. They're then having a foil stuck back on and put back into shops. And that means when you go and use it, the gift card's already been used. How can you get around this? Because obviously we don't want to just stop buying gift cards all of a sudden. Well, number one, you can move to digital gift cards. That's my one piece of advice to get around this scam, to stop it being done. And number two is if this does happen to you, don't just say, oh, well, please report it to whichever provider. It is like an absolute red flag, and every single act they should be doing is to redeem that kind of thing. Don't obviously use malpractice and try and start complaining about things and lying to them, because then you are basically doing what the criminals are doing. But just be aware that this is something going on. If you see a gift card and it looks tampered with at all before you even used it, take it straight back to the shop and get a new one. Just something to be aware of, because this apparently is a new scam that's come to the UK and it was quite popular in the US. We can stop talking about scams for now and actually start talking about those embarrassing questions, the ones that you ask every single week, or you would love to ask every single week, but you're too shy. You think you've missed the boat, you know? You wanted to ask it in school, but now you're 20 years old and you think that you should know the answer, so you just keep quiet and you're never going to ask it again. That is what we do on this show. We answer those exact questions. So if you do have one of those questions, please do DM us at ThatMoneyShow on Instagram, and we can do, hopefully, answer your very question next week, anonymously, of course. And luckily, we've had a few from last week. Let's start with Sam. Sam has asked, what is an overdraft? Is it essentially free money? This is a great question, Sam, because I feel like so many of us don't know the answer to this. We just use an overdraft because, you know, we get given it. And it's dangerous if you don't actually ask the question, but you're embarrassed to ask it, right? An overdraft is basically, think about it a bit like a credit card in a way. You're borrowing money from your bank account that you don't actually have, that you owe, and if you don't pay it, there's going to be interest charges on it. In fact, if you go into your overdraft in a lot of accounts, that's basically going under zero because your account is basically physical money that you need to have in there to spend off of it. Some banks will let you continue spending and going into negative money, but this will cost you. Maybe they'll have an allowance that allows you to pay it back by the end of the month, similar to a credit card, but a lot of them will charge you from the moment you go into it. So that's what an overdraft is. It is not free money. It is money that's probably expensive. So instead of, you know, spending £5 and then you just need to put £5 to top it up, a lot of them will charge you extra on top of doing that. So please just be aware, take a look at your bank's policy and try and avoid overdrafts altogether. And one last question that I'm going to answer today is from Isla. She said, I'm 28. Do I need life insurance and how do I go about finding a good deal? I think that life insurance is an absolute necessity. We don't know what's going to happen to us. And for the worst case scenario, we do kind of need to have ourselves covered. So I think this is a great idea. Regardless if you're 28, 38, 18 or 58, life insurance is absolutely fundamental, obviously, from the time that you get taken off your parents' policy, if you're on it. So number one, speak to your employer. A lot of them do offer it for cheap or even for free and will do it for you. And if not, please do go out and cover yourself, because there is nothing, we know these things do happen. You might not know anyone yourself, a friend or family or a distant relative, that something negative has happened. And to leave something behind to your loved ones, whether that's your parent, your spouse or your children, I think is the least you can do. And of course, these are hopefully going to be like a cheap amount every single month that does cover you in the worst case scenario, a significant amount that will make a huge financial impact positively in case of really negative occasions in people's lives. So how'd you go about finding a good deal? I didn't answer that. Just go to a comparison website, life insurance, comparison website, give it a Google, and that's all you need to know. It's really as simple as that. And that's all we have time for today. So firstly, I want to say a thank you to our two guests. We had Carrie on, the financial psychologist, and also Emmy on, our mortgage advisor. Two completely unique angles and hopefully two interesting concepts that you feel leveled up with now when it comes to your own personal finances. We then also spoke a little bit about the economy, you know, my little rants about the cost of living and house prices. I promise it won't be the same every single week, but until things do change, it's important to keep you updated on everything that's going on. And just a quick reminder to download the app and listen every single week, where we will be reporting to you and bringing you up to speed with everything personal finance. You can find us on social media at That Money Show on all platforms. And also you can listen back to this episode on every platform that you listen to podcasts on. Thank you so much. That's it for this week. I've been That Money Guy. This has been That Money Show. We'll see you next week for the next brilliant segment. Thanks for now, and see ya.